Well, hello. I've never been blessed before I've talked or taught. How wonderful. It's indeed wonderful to look out and see both people I've known for years, some 30-something years, and people who I don't know at all. And to know the whole range of people are here today. I'm really happy to be here today. I have heard of Word in Life for the number of years. I don't know, is it 5 years, 7 years, Alice?
Have you been here?
Since you've been here doing Word in Life.
30.
Well, I have heard, and I've heard of the provocative and juicy discussion. And one reason why I have never come is this happens to be my most, it is a day that I do therapy, and I've dedicated Thursdays to that for almost from the beginning, and so it was a conflict. I mean, I can do it one week, but not others. But at any case, I want you to know that the news out there of the group is good. And I hear you will continue on. When Alice takes a very much needed, I think, rest from the amount of work something like this takes. Your text also, I was just so very pleased. I imagine you're pleased with the book. And in particular, I was pleased, there was so much of it, but that how profoundly countercultural Nolan is. And especially in regard to the issue of autonomy and separation. This is something at Pacifica, even coming from a different angle, we also feel that has to be deeply confronted in the culture. That whole rugged American individualism kind of fix we have here. And so to Nolan's critique, I want to add something. And in order to do that, I want to go to a quotation from Joanna Macy, a Buddhist American. She says this, "We are not isolated skin, encapsulated egos, as much as an integral part of a larger living whole." Again, somewhere else she says, "We have not so much the task of making connection, as of discovering the interconnectedness that is already in place, and to which we are largely blind." In the opening meditation that Alice read from, that sort of sense of the deep underlying current that we can rest in, which we know as the body of Christ, but which is experienced, I think, by the whole human race, if they so wish to. So what I'd like us to do as we begin is to look around and at the people here, and to sense that river of attachment, that river of connection. I know that some of you know each other even longer than I know you. I know some of you 30 years, 32 years. But look around and see again, you've just spent time in the meditation. Dip once more again into that connection before we go on. Okay, I'm a little hoarse here, which quite possibly means that I'm a little nervous here. At any rate, it will pass, I think. I want to begin with a story. A rabbi and his cantor were standing in the synagogue one day. He was moved by the reading of the scripture, and the rabbi fell to his knees and said, "Lord, have mercy on me, for I am nobody." Likewise, the cantor, taking a break from practicing his intonation of the Torah, said, as he fell on his knees, he cried out, "Lord, have mercy on me. I am nobody." And then almost immediately, a dusty, disheveled man in the shadows fell on his knees and likewise called out, "Lord, have mercy on me, for I am nobody." With that, the cantor nudged the rabbi and said, "Would you take a look at who thinks he's a nobody?" I'm going to take a lesson or a tip from the story different from, I think, the main point of it. So we'll wind back to the main point again later. The point I want to make from the story has to be understood in Carl Jung's idea of the ego and the self. I think one of the few things I didn't particularly warm to in Nolan's description as he's moving toward this notion of the liberated self is sort of is one that I think Carl Jung does a very nice job. So let me very briefly go through a schema that captures some of what Jung has to say. This schema was actually developed by one of his followers, an L.A. Follower, Ettinger. What Jung suggests is that when we're born and we're totally unconscious, what's below this line is what's unconscious, that the ego is contained in something larger than itself, which Jung calls the self, and it's typically written with a capital S to signify something larger, larger than larger. And it is just totally embedded in it. And the process of growth, that is the process of becoming aware, of becoming conscious, of becoming ourselves, is a process that can be imaged by the ego, say, rising almost like the sun rises over the horizon. And part of it is in the place of consciousness, and part of it is in the place of unconsciousness. And this would be where all of us are, at some point or the other of the rising. It is the ego becoming, first of all, aware of itself, the self-aware ego. You know, a sort of 2- and 3- and 4-year-old kind of sense of joison, you know, of joy, of being alive. And then we continue on to do that. And what Jung sees as the goal of life is to be at a place in we recognize that that which is most deep inside of us, the self, written with a capital S, which Jung sees as synonymous with the God image, is something which we have to ultimately surrender to. That is, we develop an ego in order to surrender the ego. His idea is, though, that you must develop the ego. That is, to keep your ego unconscious would be a major failing in the task of the human. So you see, it is true that to be a nobody, you must first of all be a somebody. Okay? So in a way, we could say that the talk today is about the particular ways of how to be a somebody so that we can yield that to that which is larger than ourselves, which is really the same thing as Joanna Macy was talking about in terms of the deep river of connection with us. God with us, Emmanuel. We have so many different ways of alluding to the imminent God. The chapter today, as Allison mentioned, is getting to know oneself. Both, I think it's about getting to know one's ego, But it's also, I think, about developing one's ego. If I were writing this book, I would have maybe tweaked the title, and instead of it being Getting to Know Oneself, it would have been Getting to Know Our Many Selves. That we know inside of us that there are parts, Paul told us about it, you know, the good I want to do, I find myself not doing, and the evil I'd like to avoid, I don't. So we have many parts inside of us. Jung used a language that I don't particularly like. I hardly ever refer to it, using such things as anima, animus, the wise old man, the shadow, as different parts of us that can be identified that we could get to know. I would prefer to be maybe more generic in talking about our many parts, and I've just sort of drafted a few here, and it would be getting that we develop an ego by becoming aware and engaging some of our many parts, as for example, our lively parts and our traumatized parts, our kindly parts and our critical parts, our real parts and our pretend parts. All of those, to try to develop a relationship with them, the big task would be without becoming too preoccupied with them. You know, it's hard to skip if we're thinking about skipping. So if we want to do some of this kind of process of living, at some stage we have to be able to forget what we're doing and just live into it. About 3 days before the Super Bowl, I heard on National Public Radio this sort of analysis of what the teams had to do, in particular what the Patriots had to do in order to come out victor. And it was, you know, the Patriots had this incredible moment of history that they were going to be able to achieve. And the person said, but the tax is like this. It's like having $1 million over there and being told you can have it if you don't think about it. So we have a kind of paradox in the spiritual life. And it's the paradox of striving for $1 million, striving for everlasting life, striving for the liberated ego. And yet, one of our biggest I think barriers is preoccupation with it. That is being too sort of concerned or worried about ourselves and how we're doing, taking our spiritual temperature, so to speak. I'm going to come back to that thought again. Nolan in the text talks about how to go about knowing oneself in the pursuit of self-knowledge, and in it he talked about the danger of hypocrisy. If you read it, I'm sure you remember that, where he said that the ultimate contradiction is to be proud of our humility. Mm-hmm. You know? And of course that's the main point of the opening story, right? If you're a nobody, you can't call yourself a nobody. You know. The other thing that he talked about, and had some good things to say, I imagine you would find even a second reading valuable, he talked about the downward pull of a guilt complex. And I will touch on that point too in some of the thoughts I'm going to develop. Because what I see both of these things, points that he makes, have in common is that they are talking about how do we free ourselves from self-preoccupation. Because one is only proud of one's humility if one's sort of like, you know, navel-gazing over it. Or one's only really under the pull of terrible guilt complex, it once caught up in that kind of dynamic. Another thing that Nolan mentioned in his chapter is one that therapists like to talk about a lot, and that is the importance of feeling our feelings. Okay, what we could call leaning into life rather than avoiding it. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about is with the idea of how can we lean into life rather than avoid it. Another image that I particularly like is when things go wrong, how can you steer in the direction of the skin? That's the only way you will, again, get engaged. Not necessarily get control, but get engaged. For those of you who have lived all your life in California, you might not know about steering in the direction of the skin on icy roads. So what I want to engage in today is what I see, both from a spiritual direction or a spirituality point of view, or from a point of view of therapy, which is where I spend most of my time. I see this as a sine qua non, and that is how to learn and practice empathy for ourselves, empathy for our many parts. I see this as like almost a prerequisite if we are to do the major task that is foster compassion for all sentient beings. And that's how the Buddhists say it. But, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. And love your God with your whole heart. So how do we do this? What do we need? It seems to me we need help in learning how to have compassion for oneself. In preparing the thoughts, I struggled as to whether to develop my thoughts along the lines of Jungian practice, or Christian practice, or Buddhist practice. And somehow or the other, I'm going to try to do all three. But I'm going to begin with a quotation from Carl Jung. It's toward the end of his book, Modern Man in Search of a Soul. Perhaps this sounds very simple, but simple things are always the most difficult. In actual life, it requires the greatest discipline to be simple. And the acceptance of oneself is the essence of the moral problem and the epitome of a whole outlook upon life. He goes on. That I feed the hungry, that I forgive an insult, that I love my enemy in the name of Christ, all these are undoubtedly great virtues. What I do unto the least of my brethren, that I do unto Christ. But what if I should discover that the least among them all, the poorest of all the beggars, the most impudent of all the offenders, the very enemy himself, that these are within me, and that I myself stand in need of the alms of my own kindness? That I am the enemy who must be loved. What then? As a rule, the Christian's attitude is then reversed, and there is no longer any question of love or long suffering. We say to the brother, the sister within us, raka, thy fool, and condemn and rage against ourselves. We hide it from the world. We refuse to admit ever having met this least among the lowly in ourselves. Had it been God himself who drew near to us in this despicable form, we should have denied him 1,000 times before a single cock had crowed. I should know by now that if I take on doing a program that involves stuff like this, I suffer it before the presentation. I used to give a lot of programs called Befriending the Shadow, And I could count on my shadow erupting in multiple and previously unknown forms, both before, during, and after the presentation. And this time was no exception.
Don?
Yes?
Could you do me a favor and set the cup on the table?
Oh, okay. You're afraid I'm going to baptize myself. Okay, so what Jung says, that acceptance of oneself is the essence of the moral problem. I believe that many of us are conditioned, I think that's an important word here, to construe morality as being ruthless, critical, maybe even cruel to ourselves. A test. How many of us, when we really mess up, I don't know how far back you have to go to think of that, but how many of us grieve that we are unable to receive and experience the mercies of God? Is that our grief? Or is it that we're more likely to grieve not being perfect? Now, actually, when we do have a shift and we come into an ownership of something not so lovely of ourselves, I do think we have to grieve. I really think that before we can really receive the mercies of God, we have to in some way grieve that we've moved another notch in confronting that we're not God. Mm-hmm. You know, see, when we were two or something like that, a large part of us thought we were God. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was okay, it was cute. It's just after a while, you know, it doesn't work anymore. And it can't be undergone or experienced without some way feeling like a piece was chipped out of us. And so, actually, I think grief is important as a way to metabolize that knowing that I am... you know, I'm not perfect. I'm going to just digress from here for a minute. I'm always in amazement at how incredible a package is the AA, Alcoholic Anonymous 10 steps, 12 steps. The thing that I don't know if you know, there was a connection between one of the writers of it and Carl Jung. There's a wonderful letter that we Jungians like to look at, where Jung wrote to one of these men, and he basically saw that the work had to do with the spirit, and that people were sort of engaged with the spirits because they weren't engaging the spirit. And so I thought, well, let me just look at this program a little more. And I have rewritten the first three steps. And it goes something like this. I actually don't know the exact verbatim of the steps, but you'll recognize it. It comes to something like this. I've come to terms with the fact that my life is out of control due to the fact that I'm a human. And the second is then that I believe there's a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And then the third is I hand over my life to that power greater than myself. That's really this process. We develop an ego, we develop consciousness, and the rest of the steps are about developing consciousness. You know, the fourth, fifth, and relating to other people, but also relating to doing that third step, which is handing over myself to the power greater than myself as I have come to know her. Yeah. So to get some idea of our attitude toward ourselves, because even that can be hidden, I think we have to sometimes listen to our self-talk. Okay? And when we listen to our self-talk, is it mainly on our case or is it mainly on our side? If we can become aware of how we talk to ourselves. I think few of us, and that's what confronted this, and I think, now of course I know that many of you have confronted this as something, but few of us would talk to other people with the words or the tone of voice that we talk to ourselves. And I have to say, it's no good. Any more than we know that if we were going to have the privilege of raising a child, we know that if we talk to them with contempt and derision and condescension, that child isn't going to flower. Well, the same way that kind of talk to ourselves is going to produce a shrunken, shriveled ego, not one that can take on the job of seeing, you know, seeing who I am, let alone relating to it. I think we sometimes call ourselves Raca, that fool, in the biblical passage that Jung refers to. I think we do that, though, more through frustration, because we don't know how to practice a real deep compassion. We don't know how to practice a real deep compassion. I knew this, and I, you know, still struggle with this, but I have found that in the last 3 years, 4 years, something has deeply shifted in me. And the person who helped me more than anyone else was Pema Chandra. I have about 5 or 7 of her books back there and a photograph of her that was in Oprah's most recent Pema Chandra. She is an American Buddhist nun. She has a place up in, I think, Nova Scotia, or if not New Brunswick, somewhere in the Canadian Northeast. She was a Catholic. Many of you I know are Catholics. She was a Catholic, and she had a bunch of children, and her husband walked out on her one day, and she said, I'm not recommending this, folks. But then her life began that day, because I think that she was very unconscious in her Catholicism, and she sought solace, and where she found help was in Buddhism. Well, I know I'm not a Buddhist. There are a lot of things about Buddhism that I, you know, don't experience as my map for the spiritual life. But I think the, you know, 4,000 years, 5,000 years they had of practice tells us something about humans that we don't have in Catholicism, we don't have in Christianity at that same level. However, in the past I had tried, I had used Thich Nhat Hanh, I had used the Dalai Lama, and nothing has touched me as Pema Chandra. I think it's because she has the American idiom. Mm-hmm. And so she can bring up images that only an American, you know, who knows our experience could. And these images have somehow or the other helped me keep butt in seat, butt in chair for meditation every morning. I find using her books, in which I just stay with maybe one paragraph for 20 minutes, has done what I'm going to talk as we go about. It's helped me learn how to open my heart. We sang that. Open my heart, not only to the world, but open my heart to myself and my own brokenness and confusion and whatever. Alice Walker from The Color Purple writes, it's on the cover of one of Pema's books, she writes, as one of Pema Chandran's grateful students, I've been learning the most pressing and necessary lesson of all, how to keep opening wider my own heart. Pema describes the Buddhist practice of bodhicitta, it's a Sanskrit word, as our ability to keep our hearts and minds open to, and I've filled in a whole bunch of things. Open to suffering, to fear, to cynicism, my big one, to uncertainties, to our foibles, to our littleness, and to do that without shutting down. I remember having a woman friend of mine who, after breaking up with a mismatched boyfriend, telling me of fighting her inner demons of self-recrimination for ever getting into the relationship. You know it. You might not know it, but you've seen enough of what torment a person goes through. And she said to me, Dawn, the one thing I don't want for myself is I don't want my heart to harden up. To suffer what she had to suffer, which is real human suffering of loss, the loss of her own sense of judgment because she let herself be taken advantage of seriously, and not to harden her heart toward life. Well, Pema has something similar to say. She opens one of her books and she says, when I was 6 years old, I received an essential bodhicitta teaching from an old woman sitting in the sun. She would have been a Catholic back then, okay? I was walking by her home one day feeling lonely, unloved, and mad. You could just see a six-year-old lonely, unloved, and mad. I was kicking anything I could find. Laughing, she said to me, little girl, don't you go letting life harden your heart. So we can say that to ourselves at any age. The practice of bodhicitta is a simple practice, but as a practice it must be done. And it is hard to do. It's not enough to just think about it. So I have prepared a couple of exercises. I can see already I'm not going to finish everything, but let's start with at least one exercise. The second I might have to let go. So this is how Pema suggests you be, and please take the freedom of doing the exercise or not, but I assure you that the process only works when you ultimately do it, even if you only do it at home but not here. So she suggests that you're seated, legs crossed comfortably, torso upright, a strong back, an open front, hands open, palms down, eyes open, mouth slightly open, and jaw relaxed. And we begin by paying attention to the breathing, paying attention to the out-breath. Touch it and let it go. To the out-breath, touch it and let it go. To the out-breath, touch it and let it go. Now, let us be aware of some suffering we noticed this morning. It could be ours, our arthritis, or someone close. It might be world suffering like the tornadoes in the Midwest, Kenya, Darfur. Pick one. Just one suffering. Pick one. And again, using the breathing, the out-breath, touch it and let it go. Let us open wide our hearts to it. Continue the breathing while you open wide your heart. For the moment, set aside anything else that comes up, like trying to solve it or feeling guilty about it. Open wide our hearts, allowing our hearts to become softer to it, friendlier to it. And allow yourself, if you do, to feel the powerlessness or impotence that often comes up here. Just trying with each breath only to open wide your heart. Just take a few moments to do this. Then I'm going to ask you to bring it to a close, which what might mean you say to it, "Oh, I'll come back to you later, honey." Then I'd like to ask if there's one or two people who would just briefly describe what that experience was like for you. Yeah.
Like softening within the body.
Uh-huh.
Actually within the heart area.
You could actually feel your heart area. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
I can feel not necessarily a softening, more of a gripping as I started to cry.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's like a forgiving my body for all the tests it's been up with.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Another person, yes.
I noticed a shift away from trying to hold it off. Just releasing it. I realized now it's holding a lot of tension.
Yeah. And I'm going to move on from here because with all three of you, you've given me some of the points I want to move on this. And that is often when we do this, we get a shift. And the thing might not have changed, but we have a shift in our relation to it. We have sometimes actually what can almost be like a moment of real grace where we feel forgiveness, so we feel something in that vein. We feel grace that can happen, and it can happen in something as brief as this, but this is really brief. It's not unusual that when we consider problems, our own, but especially world problems, that we feel guilty. You know, the downward pull of guilt that Nolan mentioned. And the guilt is often in the form that I'm not doing more. In fact, I remember that at La Casa de Maria, when we would try to do peace and justice workshops, that often, you know, we got a small attendance. And when we changed it, sort of tweaked it a different way in peace and justice, who came in another form in the day, people were always very happy to be able there. But when we found out that people avoided coming because they didn't want to have to feel guilty, and they thought if they did that. So the task is, how can we engage these incredible issues that are out there in the world and do it without feeling a downward pull of guilt? Now, I'm not saying that we don't feel responsibility, because, you know, to whatever extent we're responsible, we could be. But guilt is in some way a kind of useless act of self-punishment. I'm using it in that fashion today. So there's some value if we can learn this practice of compassion. The book today had this wonderful image of the woman who came to Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and Nolan talks about it as being sort of a shift to gratitude, and I could hear inside each of you touching at least a little bit on a feeling of gratitude that you could relate to this hurt maybe a little differently than before. This is the kind of thing that I'm not thinking that I'm telling you something you've never heard. If there's a piece, I hope, is that you've got to do it to feel the benefit of it. It's not enough to have a notional idea. And if you have a practice already, and I would encourage you to either add this to your practice, a practice of unconditional compassion to whatever frailty is inside. Al Gore, in a recent book, Assault on Reason, he talks of this. He says that many of us have been traumatized, maybe as children, maybe traumatized somewhere along the line. And he said that there's a big difference between how we remember trauma and how we remember events in the past. And that the difference is there's no timeline with trauma. If I remember skipping as a child or an incident like Pema has, we know it's in the past. But when we in some way are in touch with something that traumatized us, it is present. And so he suggests that we do either of two things. One is find ways to discharge the trauma. And he in particular talked about the truth and reconciliation rituals as a way to discharge the trauma. Or that we avoid things that habitually traumatize us. And he does that because he said that that too many people walk around with an air of victimization. And I don't know if you've ever felt that six-year-old image that we had there of wanting to kick the stones. You know, one of our inside parts can be the victim within. And that when we re-traumatize that victim, because that victim became victim through something, then we sort of strengthen those lines. And so he said, you know, it was interesting, somebody who was so much in media, that we might need to avoid certain movies or television. Because that is already a certain reading. That can be a way in which we're strengthening those neurological pathways. And then on the other side, you know, this practice of compassion builds up and strengthens other neurological pathways. So, being on our side doesn't mean that we say to ourselves that messing up or missing the mark doesn't matter. However, our attitude toward missing the mark, if it is contemptuous or disdainful or exasperated, we are hardening our hearts. We're not doing reparation. We're not doing repairing. The gospel, on the other hand, is one of kindness. How would we be to the lost parts of ourselves? Like a shepherd. Like a woman looking for a lost coin. Like a mother hen gathered chicks, you know. Like a prodigal father. So let's see where we are. Well, I'm not going to do this next exercise. I'll tell you about it, and then I'll try to bring my comments to a close instead. What I was going to have you do is a real hard one, and that is to soften to some fear. Now, I think this is a good beginning place of doing an exercise of softening. Fear is being used in our country at an incredibly intense level. You know, I think we all see how George Bush is doing it, but I want to tell you, he's a baby in comparison to how it's been used for the last 20 to 30 years. And if you want an immersion into it, I recommend Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, The Shock Doctrine. And she talks about how this doctrine, formulated by neoliberals, which I think I would prefer to call them neolibertarians, back with Milton Friedman, how this has been, first of all, used in South America in all those horrible stories around Chile and Argentina, you know, the mystery of the disappeared, all of that. It is an amazing document. Sorry, but I also suggest that if you read it, that you have some kind of place to laugh because it's heavy duty. So, but there are things to fear. And yet the Buddhist story tells us, much as Jesus tells us, fear not. Now, how can we work through this I think it is by developing a relationship to the things we feel, softening our heart. I mean, there are things we fear that have to do with our country, certainly with one of the things I have to fear is I don't get my nouns anymore. I've spent most of my time lecturing, and I hardly ever go now without a sheet because, with little kids, you always say to them, use your words, Johnny. Well, those words are deserting me now. And I know many of you have that experience, and so that happened to me just now. I don't need to fill in. You know the things in the world that we have to fear. But we also have to fear personal things, like growing older that I just shared with you, being slower, maybe having a son or daughter die before one does, or having a spouse die. We have to fear things like not counting. We don't have maybe the juiciness we used to have. But ultimately, the fear is the fear of uncertainty. And I have found that Pema and how she couches it has helped me enormously. Because you see, some of the things we fear we're losing, we never had. And what we had was a sort of fantasy of control. Or we didn't have them all that permanently. We had a very unreliable relation to them. So we would have done that exercise, and it would have taken us more time than I... and you might do that later today. I would have asked you, as you brought it to a close, if you had experienced any shift in your attitude toward the fear, or toward fear itself. And if so, I think that, and this is where I'm going to ask us just to sort of finish today with, is transitioning to a place of gratitude. Gratitude for our capacity to soften our hearts. Gratitude to whatever emerges out of today for yourself. Nolan says in chapter 10 that the self-centered ego prevents it from being truly grateful. And I think that's true. I think after you've exercised gentleness toward yourself, you'll find that it's easier to be grateful. It's sort of like they go together. So there is one last point. Am I okay, Alice? Okay. And it has to do with some new research that's being done. And this research, I read an account of it as a book called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain. It's written by Sharon Begley, who writes for science articles in Newsweek and maybe the Wall Street Journal. And it was a convocation of the Dalai Lama and Buddhists and people from the Salk Institute in La Jolla, in particular a researcher called Fred Gage. And what they wanted to do was to have some idea of what was happening in the brain when the monks prayed. Well, prior to that, at the Salk Institute, what they were discovering was something which 10 years ago, was absolutely mind-boggling. Most of you most likely have heard that we don't make brain cells. That our brain cells, we are stuck with ones that we had when we were born, like our ovaries, No, ovaries don't replicate, and neither do brain cells don't replicate, but new brain cells can be born out of our existing stem cells. Brain cells don't go through mitosis, But new ones can come out of our existing stem cells. And what do you think they discovered? They discovered that being in a place of gratitude, practicing gratitude, practicing the kind of attention that the Buddhists would call, you know, meditation, mindfulness, that these foster neurogenesis. And they know this by hooking people up and seeing that part of your brain, the amygdala, really active. You know, other parts of the brain are really, you're in delta with rhythms. But that's not the whole story. It's that other parts of the brain are active. There was one other thing that they had found in these studies prior to the Buddhist connection and this particular point, and it was that the main way they see neurogenesis happening, and they discovered it first in rats, and that is through freely chosen exercise. The rat that gets on its wheel, that he is going to develop new brain cells. The rat that's thrown in a vat of water and has to run like mad in order to try to find some place that he can get out of the water, he's going to have so much stress that it won't work. Okay, so freely chosen exercise, even exercise that looks like a treadmill, has this capacity. And you can Google it if you want. You know, things like gauge and exercise, Fred Gage is the same, and you will, you know, can get some articles on that. So if you put all of that together, you know, put together exercise and attention. I have a friend who goes up into the mountains in Topanga every morning with her dog, the hills. And there she's sort of like, we could call it space out, but mindfulness of her environment. You know, she must be making brain cells right and left. I thank you, and let's go have something and come back and raise any questions.